This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the World Health Organization has made a pair of recent recommendations about artificial sweeteners like aspartame. We'll talk to a Wisconsin biochemist about how our bodies process alternatives to sugar and what they mean for our health. Now, former President Donald Trump is facing another potential indictment. Federal officials are investigating Trump's involvement in the events leading up to the Capitol riot on January 6th. Plus, Michigan's Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel is charging 16 false electors with forgery felonies for efforts to overturn the state's 2020 presidential results. We're digging into some of the political and legal questions surrounding those cases, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know about the federal probe into Trump's actions after the 2020 elections leading up to January 6th? Should the former president be federally indicted? Does it matter that he's a leading candidate for president in his party right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. Great to be here.
We have this target letter the former president says he's received from special counsel Jack Smith. What do we know at this point about this investigation into Trump and a potential indictment?
Well, we know that this is a big deal, first of all. This is an investigation that's been going on for quite some time now. Jack Smith has been interviewing dozens of witnesses as part of this. And so we're all waiting for the actual results here. What might the charges be? But at this point, we know that there's been a long time investigation of course, a former president and perhaps future presidential candidate here. So this is really unprecedented in American history.
Let's talk about the process a little bit. Merrick Garland, the attorney general, didn't seem like he was in a hurry to investigate or charge these things for the former president. Gets into the presidential race. Garland hands it over to this special counsel. Can you talk about that? Does that make a difference in terms of the independence of this investigation?
Yeah, I think Merrick Garland, I mean, he certainly realized the difficulty and the unprecedented nature of this investigation, and so wanted to put as many layers of independence between the investigation and the Department of Justice and the Biden administration more generally. And so when Merrick Garland appointed Jack Smith, it was very much with that in mind. And what that allows is it allows Jack Smith, who's, you know, a very experienced counsel, it allows him more freedom, more independence to carry out this investigation, not only independence from the administration, but more independence from charges that he's politically motivated. Of course, those charges are still coming. Former President Trump has certainly had many things to say about Jack Smith. But nevertheless, those additional layers in a case like this were, in Merrick Garland's estimation, very much necessary before the whole thing could begin.
The target letter I mentioned includes a few possible lines of inquiry here and charges, including deprivation of rights, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and witness tampering. Now, we won't know until when and if indictments are issued what exactly they'll be, but what are your thoughts on those as the sort of lines of investigation?
Yeah, they're very interesting. I mean, the deprivation of rights, I think, was particularly surprising. That's based upon a Civil War era statute that originally was meant to target the KKK and domestic terrorism, particularly against recently freed slaves. And so that statute has been on the books for quite some time. And I think the potential theory there is that the deprivation of rights could be that it's depriving people essentially of voting rights by trying to overturn an election. So I think that's one of the juicier potential charges here. And, you know, the other ones I think are consistent with what a lot of, when Congress was investigating this as part of the January 6th committee investigating what happened during the assault on the Capitol, there were some recommended charges there as well, including inciting insurrection, obstruction of official proceeding of Congress. And so all of these, so what we know already as from the target letter and what we know from the January 6th commission, any of those potential charges could be part of an actual indictment. So we'll have to wait and see to see what we actually get. But these would very much be very juicy, very major charges.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at current and potential future charges against former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, thanks. The thing is, Trump keeps trying to obstruct, and if Trump gets to have the any of the trials pushed till after the election, then Trump or some other Republican is probably going to offer up or even write out a pardon.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. And Paul, with an existing set of indictments now, these related to the removal of classified documents, the ones at Mar-a-Lago, and obstruction of justice related to those. The former president, his legal team tried to get that trial pushed back past, as Dennis said, past the next presidential election. Jack Smith wanted it. The special counsel wanted it earlier. The judge in the case seems to have split the difference May of next year, right in the middle of the presidential, the primary campaign there. The timing and the efforts to hold off these trials, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this just raises so many questions for sure. And there's going to be a lot of this back and forth between the legal teams to try to scurry for advantage one way or another. But absolutely, I mean, we're faced, even in the other trial, we'll see what happens with this one. But in the documents case, exactly, May 20th, we're set for the trial. I mean, that's exactly around the time that you would typically know who the nominee for the parties would be. And it very well is looking like at this point that it could be Donald Trump. And so that timing is very interesting in the lead up to the November elections. And then some of the questions that, you know, Dennis raised there about whether, let's say that Trump was elected again, he becomes president, would he be able to pardon himself? I mean, how would this work in the federal cases? Those are all questions that have never been addressed before in American history. So they are weighty questions and really difficult ones as well.
Thanks for that call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. Another thread, a legal thread, coming out of the 2020 elections. We had multiple states where Joe Biden won. Republicans, electors gathered, signed paperwork declaring themselves the electors. In one state, Pennsylvania, they said, if the court overturns the outcome as we see it now, the rest of the states, including Wisconsin, they didn't. Now, here's Michigan, another one of those states. The attorney general there filed criminal charges against these electors. People have called them the fake electors for this effort. What do you think of it's been quite a while now. What do you think of those charges being filed? What does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's showing that the universe of potential cases here is very large. I mean, the Department of Justice on the federal level has been charging a number of people involved in the January 6th insurrection. So that's been ongoing. But now with the state of Michigan, their attorney general bringing charges against these so-called fake electors, that really raises the bar for expanding this outward in a number of ways. And I say that in relation to the Jack Smith federal investigation as well, because one thing to remember here is that we know that Trump got a target letter because Trump was very vocal about this on social media about how he got this target letter. But there very well may be others that received target letters and are just being quiet about it. We know that Smith's investigation wasn't just of Trump and of January 6th, but the broader effort to potentially overturn an election. And so I think the Michigan action may throw another wrinkle into the whole thing about how some of these fake electors may be targeted even federally for potentially their role in overturning an election.
Now, the argument there, Paul, I think is, if I was one of the people who would sign one of these, I would say, and many of them have, no, we were just signing this thing. So it was there. If one of these long shot court cases did tip the balance, then we're not, left without electors in the event that somehow Trump ended up prevailing in a state like Michigan or Wisconsin. Other people have pointed toward the effort to hand these lists of electors, these statements by these Republican non-electors to Vice President Pence, an aide to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. tried to communicate that to Mike Pence on January 6th and pointing to this as, no, this is a conspiracy to overturn the election. How do courts, if it comes to that, weigh those two arguments?
Yeah, I mean, and this is going to be where it's really interesting in the federal investigation, whether they've introduced any new facts when we see an indictment. I mean, if the documents case is any indication here, Jack Smith is quite willing to put out what are often referred to as talking indictments or speaking indictments. Essentially, they're telling a story about what happened, putting all the facts together and saying how it all comes together in these charges. One thing that'll be really interesting to see is whether there's additional evidence about how these fake electors acted. And that evidence might help courts to figure out who's telling the truth here. Was this just an effort to try to, put something out there in case courts overturn some of the elections results from the 2020 election? Or were they going even further in a way that was knowingly trying to overturn a lawful election? And so those additional facts, they could be in any indictment, and that'll be something very much to look out for.
Paul Nolet is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about former President Trump's current and potential criminal indictments and other cases related to the 2020 election outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We were just talking about those self-appointed alternate electors. Should Wisconsin's Republicans who signed on to these elector papers face criminal charges as those in Michigan did? What questions do you have about potential new charges or the existing indictments against former President Trump? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about former President Trump's legal troubles as he faces another possible federal indictment, this one stemming from efforts to overturn the 2020 election outcome. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Hi. So when he declared his candidacy, Mr. Trump, it seemed exceedingly early, almost 2 years before the election. And I wondered if you could comment on whether you see that as having been part of his legal strategy as a defense against his legal issues. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, George. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, there's a couple things going on here. We know that Trump very much likes campaigning. He likes talking to large crowds and that sort of thing. And so that's probably part of why he wanted to declare early. But absolutely, I mean, by declaring early and becoming a candidate, that put additional pressure on the Department of Justice when it was thinking about its legal strategy. And, you know, that eventually led to, as we talked about before, you know, Merrick Garland appointing Jack Smith as the special counsel here. So I do think that that was part of the strategy, knowing that there were going to be legal ramifications for a number of things once he was no longer president. This complicates matter when he's not only a candidate for the presidency, but far and away the leading candidate currently for the Republican nomination.
Thanks for that call. Logan from Madison called in, couldn't stay on the line. Logan says it feels like investigations into President Joe Biden and his family aren't getting the same level of attention as Trump's investigations. And Paul, there's a couple lines going on there. First of all, we had a federal prosecutor, a Trump appointee. The Biden Justice Department left him in power in Delaware, in effect, to complete that investigation of Hunter Biden. And then we've got investigations in the U.S. House looking at various accusations related to Hunter Biden, mostly some they say to Joe Biden. Are we paying enough attention to that now?
Well, I think at the end of the day, what matters are the facts. And, you know, as you mentioned, the House is currently undergoing an investigation of Biden and family members. And there have been investigations ongoing for quite some time. So I think at the end of the day, the whatever facts are going to be uncovered is going to help drive the coverage here. And again, we don't know all the facts from the Jack Smith investigation either. We know a number of facts from the January 6th committee that eventually submitted an over 800-page report that had a number of concerning aspects about a number of people that potentially were involved in trying to overturn an election. So I think at the end of the day, you know, the facts will speak, and whether if there is anything there with Biden and family members in that investigation, then you know, that'll help drive the level of coverage, I think, and the seriousness of any potential charges related to those.
Talking to political scientist Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the latest legal inquiries, possible new set of indictments coming for former President Trump. Paul, let's look at the current set out there. First of all, the federal indictments into the classified documents case, as we mentioned, this case going to trial May 20th, I think you said. The judge said, hey, this is a complex case. There's a lot. We're going to need a good long time. What happens between now and that trial so many months away?
Yeah, and that's where I think, you know, you're going to have the sides wrangling kind of legally over process, but also over substance as well in terms of how they present their cases and organize and marshal the evidence before the trial. And, you know, thinking about it politically as well, it's such an awkward thing, as we talked about before, where this could be right around the moment that Trump perhaps has the nomination wrapped up. And so I think part of the strategizing there is not just legally, but politically on the part of the Department of Justice, you know, what gaming out of a variety of different scenarios. What if Trump isn't the nominee? What if he is the nominee? You know, and thinking about how that might affect the legal strategy here. And one other thing that I'd mentioned as well, the Manhattan case, so the falsifying business records case that was brought by Alvin Bragg, the local prosecutor. You know, the twist there, those charges, I would say, you know, aren't nearly to the level, in my estimation, as the documents case and especially the election case ongoing at the federal level. But the twist is that while, you know, Trump becoming president and potentially pardoning himself or stopping these investigations at the federal level might be a possibility, the president doesn't have that sort of power to stop a state investigation. Mm-hmm. So that does add an additional twist to the whole situation as well. And we also shouldn't forget that there's an ongoing investigation in Georgia as well pertaining to the election. And the prosecutors there said that there could be potential indictments as early as mid-August. So that's another legal twist to the whole situation.
A question that our listeners bring up sometimes is, if a person is under indictment or if a person is found guilty of felonies, does that prevent that person from running for president and, if winning, becoming president? And my understanding is, nope, not at all. You can run for president from a prison cell if you want to.
Yes. In fact, that has a clear and short answer. No, it does not prevent a person running for president. The Constitution has a very limited number of qualifications. You know, natural born citizen, 35 years old. But if the person is under federal indictment or even in prison, that does not prevent somebody from running for president and potentially even winning and becoming president while in prison. So all of these are, I mean, they almost seem like fantasy. If you went back 10 years ago and brought up these scenarios, mm-hmm. It would be really fanciful. But here we are in potentially facing these sorts of questions.
We've focused mostly on the legal side of things today, Paul. I want to get into a little of the politics because it's certainly there. We've got a big and it seems like ever-growing field of candidates in this Republican primary. A lot of those candidates being very careful. They want to win the nomination instead of former President Trump. Only a couple of them, and seems like a couple of the long shots, willing to criticize the president. A lot of the other candidates defending the former president, saying he shouldn't be subject to these criminal charges. How is this all affecting the politics of this Republican primary campaign?
Yeah, and I think really a lot of these candidates are just trying to balance the fact that Trump remains a very popular figure amongst the Republican base, overwhelmingly so, with the possibility that Trump could implode. Of course, we've said that many times before. But I do think, with these election-related charges, this potentially could change the dynamic in ways that the other investigations didn't. Now, I'm certainly not guaranteeing that mm-hmm. would happen. We've seen so far that when these indictments, the previous two, came down, that Trump actually moved up in the polls. But there's a possibility that there could be a Trump weariness going on even amongst Republican voters. And if that does happen, then there's a number of candidates, as you mentioned, that are there to pick up the slack. And so a lot of them are in this holding pattern where they can't criticize Trump, but they want him to implode at the same time. So it's a difficult balancing act.
Do you think, just in our last minute, there's something in the nature of potential indictments over the 2020 election outcome that would work differently, that would read differently?
Yeah, I do, because number one, it deals with the election and certain types of very sensitive conspiracy theories that get to voting rights and that sort of thing. But also it brings up the specter again of January 6th and what happened on that day. And that's something that I don't think a lot of Republicans want to talk about. Republicans that were very willing in the week or so after January 6th to criticize openly Donald Trump. And so it'll bring back a lot of that. That a lot of Republicans don't necessarily want to bring up in the context of a presidential campaign.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Paul Nolet, Marquette University Associate Professor of Political Science. We've been talking about the legal cases surrounding former President Trump and efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, plus charges in our neighboring state, Michigan, against the Republicans who signed on as electors, even though President Biden had won their state. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, so-called artificial intelligence programs are shaking up the media world, and they're playing a part in the ongoing strikes in the entertainment industry, the writers and actors strikes. Get the latest on AI, artificial intelligence, how it's being used, especially when it comes to the creative industry and for media and reporting now, and join in with your questions and your reactions. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. It's Tuesday, and maybe you're thinking of having tacos for dinner. But can you legally call it Taco Tuesday? After a settlement reached last week, you are in the clear. As reported by NPR, the chain Taco John's held a trademark to the phrase Taco Tuesday going back to 1989, except in New Jersey for some reason. That meant that other restaurants and bars faced legal risk if they advertised the phrase Taco Tuesday. But the much larger chain Taco Bell issued a legal challenge saying Taco Tuesday is a common phrase, shouldn't be subject to trademark. Taco John's announced they'd give up that trademark last week, declaring themselves to be, quote, lovers, not fighters. Now, of course, if you'd wanted to declare your family dinner night to be Taco Tuesday, no one is going to sue you for that, unless you advertise it and charge people to sit at your kitchen table. A happy Taco Tuesday to all who celebrate. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, meet two war correspondents who give us a behind-the-scenes look at the dangerous job of reporting from a war zone. And they'll tell us why they do it. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the World Health Organization recently released two health advisories related to artificial sweeteners. In May, the WHO recommended against the use of non-sugar sweeteners for the goal of reducing body weight. And earlier this month, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified the artificial sweetener aspartame as possibly carcinogenic to humans. Dr. Francesco Branca, who directs the Department of Nutrition and Food Safety at the World Health Organization, said most people do not consume enough aspartame to be at risk, but the finding shows a need for further research.
We are comfortable that the occasional level of exposure, which is far from the acceptable daily intake, is safe or is not producing appreciable health risk. The problem is for high consumers, and the problem is for situations where consumption are shifting towards high consumer. But I think our results do not indicate that occasional consumption should pose a risk to most consumers.
The FDA says it still considers aspartame safe for human consumption under current regulations. So what's a consumer to do with this information? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions or concerns do you have about natural or artificial sweeteners? Do you avoid some or all of them? Do you feel like some affect you differently than others? Do you like artificial sweeteners maybe better than regular sugar? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, is an assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin. Her lab researches natural and artificial sweeteners and how they influence pregnancy, development, and metabolism. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, with this news from the World Health Organization, it seems like, okay, a little concern, need for no research. It doesn't seem like anybody's saying we should be panicking about our artificial sweeteners right now. Does that feel about right to you?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly the take-home message of this. The World Health Organization is calling for more basic research on aspartame. There was some alarming study, and I think that's what this report was filled in the first place. But it's really, for now, at least, we really do not have enough evidence based on the amount of person that were assessed in those study. We do not have statistical power to say that there is for sure a risk. And so we just need to do a lot more to be able to assess that.
You do a lot of research related to artificial sweeteners, and we'll get into that. But first of all, can you tell us, what are they? What goes into making aspartame that makes it a sweetener that we can use?
Yeah, so there's, as you mentioned, there's different category of artificial sweeteners and natural sweeteners. So we differentiate them by the fact that either they're man-made, so they were created by us. They do not exist in natural form in nature, versus natural sweeteners such as stevia, monk fruit, who are actually found in plants, naturally found in plants and extracted from it. Artificial sweeteners are made and just have been found to taste sweet, and compared to natural sugar, which is our common table sugar, for example, we do not get any calories from it. So they've been advertised for not having any effect on our blood sugar, for example. They just are good to taste sweet for us, but that's it. They do not trigger any metabolic response from it.
Which seems a little weird. What do we know about what our body is doing with, say, aspartame?
Yeah, so there's also subcategories in those artificial sweeteners. So aspartame is a really a separate case almost from all of the other artificial sweeteners. Aspartame is actually break down by our body and makes other molecules, including phenylalanine, methanol, and so aspartame, this is what it does, but neither of those molecules makes a caloric input. So it doesn't transform artificial sweeteners into a sugar that we can actually make energy from or store as fat, for example, or do anything else. And all of the other sweeteners, so we know saccharin, for example, like Sweet and Low brand, sucralose, like Splenda, all of those are actually intact molecule. They're called inert. And so they do travel our body, but we don't break them down into anything else. So they're excreted the same way we ingest them.
Now, you mentioned aspartame breaks down into phenylalanine. Now, there's the condition of, what is it, phenylketonuria, that people are supposed to avoid that. Are people with PKU, phenylketonuria, they should avoid aspartame. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's been recommended by the FDA a while ago, as soon as it was put into food. This condition is a rare genetic disease where people cannot break down phenylalanine, and they build up phenylalanine in their body and it becomes toxic. And so usually what we recommend for those people is to get on a low phenylalanine diet. So they should monitor really their phenylalanine input. And so they are one of the category where they should not have aspartame at all in their diet.
We're talking to Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at aspartame, other artificial sweeteners. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on artificial sweeteners. Do you use them instead of sugary stuff? Do you avoid them? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie, this is a big subject of your research, including with during pregnancy. What kind of things are you looking at when it comes to artificial sweeteners?
Yeah, so my laboratory, we're interested in actually we're not really looking into aspartame. We're actually looking at two other sweeteners called sucralose and acesulfame potassium. And so those two sweeteners are the most commonly combination in diet sodas, for example. So every single diet soda you find out there usually have both sweeteners in there. And so what we are looking at is actually potentially what the effect could be during pregnancy. So if a mother would drink artificial sweeteners during pregnancy and the effect on the offspring. So I'm a basic scientist. I'm a biochemist. So we look mostly, we mimic human model in more simple models. So animal models, usually rodent. And so we feed pregnant them artificial sweeteners, and we're looking at what the offspring have or have not, or if it's safe for pregnant women to consume.
And one big point I've seen you make elsewhere in other interviews is you'd like to see a lot more research into artificial sweeteners and what they do in our bodies and whether we pass them along. What other kind of research are you hoping to see, whether you're doing it or others around the country?
Yeah, so one other thing we've come to appreciate in our research is that we know that artificial sweeteners are safe for general population. One of the things we are starting to understand, the same way as you mentioned for the PKU patient, is that there may be some specific condition in which artificial sweetener might not be as recommended. One of the things that we are also looking at, for example, is it's a combination of artificial sweeteners consumption and something else. So let's say you would be on a heavy drug treatment, on chemotherapy, those kind of things. So do we have interaction between sweeteners and other drug, and our body cannot handle as much because of artificial sweeteners? And the same way as pregnancy, as I was saying, there's a lot to do with the offspring. The babies are a developing metabolism. And so they are trying to build up their mechanism to store glucose properly to create energy from nutrient, and having sweeteners at that time, it's kind of a hard take, because now we're training a body to say, well, this is a sweet, but it doesn't have any caloric input, which is not a normal response. And so that's kind of like where the realm where we're trying, we definitely need a lot more research to understand if it's really a good thing or not to consume during early life or pregnancy.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi there. I'm enjoying your conversation. I'm a nutritionist by trade, although I'm not practicing anymore. But the PKU, phenylketonuria, is a really serious issue. And I know aspartame has been a big part of that for years and years. And actually, I'm holding a bottle of Diet Coke in my hand right now. And it does have a warning, which is not very prominent on the label, saying fetal ketonuric contains phenylalanine, which is, like I say, it's there, but it's not very prominent. And it has other sweeteners in it which sort of dilutes the importance of the other one actually being there.
Gotcha. Cyril, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, a couple big labeling questions there. First of all, given the risk to a part of the population, should that warning be, as Cyril seems to be suggesting, more prominent?
Yeah, so it is. So for people with PKU, they've been diagnosed really early on. This is something that showed up really quickly at birth, and it's part of the screening also, early birth screening in Wisconsin particularly. They should know they would not consume. So I'm expecting those that are really have PKU diagnosed, they would know not to consume those. So I think that's fine. The labeling of artificial sweeteners is tricky in a sense that people sometimes do not recognize what a sweetener is or not. So sucralose, for example, sounds a lot like sucrose, which is our natural sugar. So 3 in 4 people cannot actually identify properly sweeteners on label. The other trick that that is on those labels is that we don't really know how much we have. So if you look at a food label or a drink label, you have a list of additives that were put on there, or like glucose. Sometimes you have vitamins, minerals, something like this. And then it starts with the higher amount and then it finished by the lower amount. But we don't really know what that amount is. And it's not required to put any amount of artificial sweeteners. So that's kind of a problem, both in research for us, because how do you assess how much a person actually consume a day? The only thing we can say is pretty much they're a frequent user. So they would do every day or not, and kind of how much diet soda they drink, something like this. But that's pretty much it. So it's hard also for consumer to assess how much they are drinking or if they are within the guideline of the FDA, for example.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, Medical College of Wisconsin biochemistry professor, looking at natural and artificial sweeteners and how they affect our health after the World Health Organization issued not a panic type warning, but saying, hey, they're possibly carcinogenic for humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, biochemistry professor at Medical College of Wisconsin, with us today for a look at recent news about artificial sweeteners. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk about this World Health Organization statement. You know, aspartame possibly carcinogenic for humans. That sounds bad, but there's other categories. Carcinogenic, probably carcinogenic, possibly and non. A lot of the things we encounter in our lives might fit into possibly or more carcinogenic.
Yeah, exactly. So they did classify. So we're just one category into kind of the carcinogenic. So it is everything in that category, usually stuff that have been submitted somehow to the WHO as a report with some studies, some basic research that have been done, and that would go into that category. So there's a lot of stuff potentially that could end up in this. And again, it is clear that the statement is that we need more research to be able to conclude this. So it is kind of a to-watch category.
Go back to our callers now. Ethan is with us in Madison. Ethan, hi.
Hi. I'm curious if consuming artificial...
I think we lost our connection with Ethan. Ethan, our producer says, was interested in whether these artificial sweeteners affect insulin response. Stephanie, what is there an impact on insulin response from consuming artificial sweeteners?
So the original idea was that sweeteners do not impact insulin response. Now, after a couple years of research now, like decades, I would say, of research now, we know that they do bind the sweet receptor, and you have sweet receptor all over your body. That's something that usually people don't think about, but we do have sweet taste receptor in our gut, for example. This is one of the places where sweetener will bind and signal to our intestine and then and our body that there is nutrient coming, there's sugar coming. And a sweet receptor cannot make the difference between a sugar and a non-nutrient sweeteners or aspartame or anything. So the response to this is to secrete hormone in the gut that will signal to ingest sugar and then metabolize it and then go with the normal sugar response. One of this normal sugar response is secretion of insulin. So we can ingest properly our glucose and then store it. So we know sweeteners impact the gut response for sure. The insulin, we're still a little bit in between. I think we still need more study for this, but it definitely does signal in the gut pretty well. As far as the downstream of insulin, increase in glucose concentration that is linked to insulin resistance, for example, this has been shown with sweeteners. So we know that long-term sweeteners exposure lead to increased basal glucose level, which is your blood sugar that would signal you for pre-diabetic.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sorry we lost the connection. William joins us now in Marshall. William, hello.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, William?
I would like to ask about the value of alcohol sugars or sugar alcohols in terms of, you know, whether they have that same response with the effect of the insulin. And also, do you have a website where we can go and read up on the man's work?
You mean on our guest research, William?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, William, thanks. First of all, alcohol sugars.
Yeah, so alcohol sugar are regulated as well by the FDA, but they're not as sweet as our nutritive sweeteners, and that's part of why they're not used as much. They're also not as cheap as produced, so we don't have as much. But like as far as what we know, they bind this receptor, but not as good as, let's say, sucralose or aspartame, and that's make them less sweet for us. So there's not a ton of sugar on research, sorry, on the sugar alcohol, like sorbitol and all of this, and their effect. The fact that they're found mainly in really small quantity and really particular product, like gum, for example, we're not expecting to ingest as much as, you know, drinking diet sodas. So I think that's part of why we don't have as much research on it. But yeah, so far so good. Let's put it this way.
And William was wondering if there's a good place to follow your research, Stephanie.
I have a website. You can find me on Medical College of Wisconsin website, and there's a lot of links on my research.
Thanks for the call. And I know we've had some people wonder also about non-artificial sweetener alternatives, things like stevia. Where do they fit into all of this? Is this part of what you research?
Yeah, so my own research, we haven't looked at stevia, but others have done it. One of the things that came out semi-recently was that they have fed patient with various quantity of stevia, and they haven't found any effect on glucose level, for example, while they did find some effect on basal, on blood sugar with saccharine and sucralose. So there is some research, but stevia is also a lot newer, like as a you know, really good substitute for artificial sweeteners. They have been used for a lot longer for example, stevia was used a lot longer by Chinese, and we haven't seen anything. They do have the same concept as far as their binding, and they bind this receptor. One of the major differences is our gut microbiome actually participate in metabolizing the stevia a little bit, and so that makes our gut microbiome work. In which way, I don't think we're sure yet. But so far, we don't have a ton of research on stevia. We have a lot more on aspartame and sucralose, for example.
Time for one more caller. Ken is with us in Black River Falls. Ken, hi.
Yeah, hello. You know, something that I was wondering about is artificial flavors. For years, I've wondered what chemists sat around figuring out, let's take these things and we'll come up with artificial vanilla. That seems impossible to even imagine doing. The other thing is, we don't really have any basic information or education when it comes to what we should be eating. I mean, I cannot imagine why I would want an artificial sweetener. If I want sugar, I'll have sugar, but I usually don't want sugar. And we have very little education on this, just none.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, if he wants sugar, he'll have sugar. Of course, we know there's downsides to having too much sugar in our lives, too. What do you end up doing in your own life, Stephanie, when it comes to how much and what sweeteners to actually use?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not going with too much sugar. That's another part of my lab research is the effect of regular sugar. So I definitely do not, and there's like really strong evidence that too much sugar doesn't help with, again, a lot of the metabolic disease, including obesity and diabetes. So definitely not in my own life. I'm not going full on regular sugar. I do use artificial sweeteners in really moderate concentration, the same way as the FDA advice. And I'm actually happy there's other alternatives now in the market, including seltzers that are naturally flavored and with really minimal sugar. And I think the same way as we train for salts, in a sense, we are good at training for sweets. The less sweet we eat, usually the better we get with not craving for sweet. So I think we can train our body to do that.
Ken, thanks for the call. And Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen is an assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin. She's with us today to explain what we know and don't know about the ways natural and artificial sweeteners influence our health. She had an interesting point there. We can train ourselves to not like sweets as much or not to crave them as much. The less we eat, the less sweet stuff we want. Well, in theory, I haven't been able to do that in my life. How about you? Have you made a decision in your life to cut back on sweets and sweeteners, whether sugar or stevia or sucralose or you name it? Let us know about it. Let me know about it. Maybe I can learn from it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, in the last month, two 16-year-olds have died doing factory work, including one here in Wisconsin. We'll check out the state of child labor laws and child labor protections around the country, plus efforts to loosen up some of those regulations in many states that are going on right now. Plus, the big EAA air show is going on this week in Oshkosh. We'll meet two women who have broken new ground in the sky as pilots, including a Wisconsinite who ended up on the Thunderbirds in the Air Force. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, have we finally reached the end of inflation? An economics reporter gives us a snapshot of the latest trends in consumer prices and where the U.S. economy may be headed. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.